For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Shira Springer. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, after another mass shooting in Florida this week, what's next for guns in America? We'll talk about that and the rest of the week's news with our Week in Review panel. Also today, we get an update from the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, including the latest on figure skater Adam Rippon.
I might not be the best in the event, but I'm definitely the most fun.
And WEEI has suspended all live programming today to undergo sensitivity training. That comes after a host used a fake Asian accent to mock Tom Brady's agent. Will this training make a difference at a station with a deep history of controversy? That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. Let's remember the 17 people brutally shot and killed on Wednesday at the Marjory Stoneham Douglas High School in Florida.
Alyssa Aladef, a 14-year-old soccer player.
Scott Beagle, 35. Was the school's cross-country coach and geography teacher.
Martin Duque Anguiano, a 14-year-old freshman.
Nicholas Duarette, a 17-year-old senior, planned on attending the University of Indianapolis.
Aaron Feiss was the assistant football coach. He was 37.
Jamie Gutenberg, she was 14.
Chris Hickson, wrestling coach and athletic director, 49.
Luke Hoyer, 15. He played on the basketball team.
Kara Loughran was 14.
Gina Montalto, a member of the marching band, 14.
Joaquim Oliver came to the U.S. from Venezuela at the age of 3. He died at 17.
Elena Petty, 14, was in JROTC and aided in the Hurricane Irma cleanup.
Meadow Pollock was 18, and she'd planned on attending Lynn University this fall.
Helena Ramsey was 17.
Alex Schachter, 14, played trombone in the marching band.
Carmen Shentrup, 16, was a National Merit Scholarship semifinalist.
Peter Wang was in the JROTC program, and during the shooting, he held a door open so others could escape. He was 15.
The alleged shooter, Nicholas Cruz, confessed to police yesterday. He used a semi-automatic AR-15 rifle and faces 17 counts of premeditated murder, one for each of those killed. Let's turn now to our Week in Review guests. Charlie Chippio, a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Hi, Charlie.
Hello.
And Susan Tracy. She's president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state rep. Susan, hi.
Thanks, Sharon.
Initial reactions. We're dealing yet again with another mass school shooting.
Yeah. Initial reactions. It's so hard to hear those names. I don't even know how to have an emotion anymore. We have been through this so many times. And I think all of us think this is the one. This is the one that's going to change it. And it's not. And I always say to myself, if Sandy Hook didn't change anything, how can anything change anything? It's so, so distressing.
Yeah. It's just such an amazing feeling of powerlessness, because it seems so clear that nobody needs to be walking around with an assault rifle. No civilian needs to be walking around with an assault rifle. Yet it's the way it is, and it isn't going to change. There's so many levels to this too. I mean, just the fact that now it's coming out that, you know, they had reason to believe this kid was planning to go shoot up a school in January, and they don't follow up on it. And, I don't know. It's just so tragic on so many levels. And maybe the most tragic thing of all is that we all sit here and know that it's not going to change.
Yeah. I want to turn to the assault rifle used. Officials report that the AR-15 rifle used in the attack was bought legally in 2017 at Sunrise Tactical Supply in Florida. And according to the New York Times, an AR-15 is easier to buy than a handgun in Florida. At a vigil last night in Florida, Fred Gutenberg, the father of victim Jamie Gutenberg, said this.
I sent her to school yesterday. She was supposed to be safe. My job is to protect my children. And I sent my kid to school. What is unfathomable is Jamie took a bullet and is dead. I don't know what I do next. My wife is home. We are broken. But I can tell you, don't tell me there's no such thing as gun violence.
Absolutely heart-wrenching.
Oh, I heard it this morning, and I just couldn't get out of my head.
Yeah. And you know, that after you've said nothing will change, is there anything that you think that can be done? Are there any steps to be taken? I know on Twitter, one of the sort of resistance movements has people, you know, as soon as a congressperson or a senator says, you know, thoughts and prayers or something to that effect, they're attaching a link or, putting together a thread that says how much the NRA or gun-related causes have donated to that particular legislator. Is that enough? Will shaming legislators make a difference? What can be done? Susan, do you have an answer?
If I had an answer, I'd implement it immediately. But the thought that I have had over the last, I guess, on all of these, but I'm just at a breaking point on it, is I think people have got to become single issue voters on this issue. And every candidate running for office needs to not just be asked if they will support an assault weapon ban, but if they actively move to make sure that it is taken up on the floor of the House and voted on. You can't hide behind, you know, being supportive. You have to put pressure on to make leadership bring these things out for a vote and take a vote on it. And the only way I think we're going to be able to fight the NRA, because the money that they have is just insurmountable, but this is truly a moment when I think the grassroots movement of, and it's bipartisan, if you look at the numbers on support, they have got to make this a single issue, and we've got to hold people accountable, and they have to take this up for a vote. And that's the only thing I can come up with.
You know, and what makes me think, I heard this morning, actually, an interview with somebody who is covering the Olympics right now, and they were saying that, she was saying that both of her camera people that she's working with are conservative, former military, and they both are absolutely adamant that this is insane and this shouldn't happen anymore. But I think in a way they are the key, because they're NRA members and they need to stop giving them those dues.
You bet.
You know, and I
Yeah, and I think what's interesting, we alluded to earlier the fact that Nicholas Cruz was someone who clearly there were signs that he was going to do something. Yep. You know, the FBI was alerted, friends, neighbors, those close to him suspected that this was a kid who could be a mass school shooter. And he himself had sent a message, I believe it was over YouTube, yep, that he wanted to be a professional school shooter. And so here's State Rep David Linsky yesterday. He is the sponsor of a bill on Beacon Hill that would let family members, judges, and caretakers temporarily suspend a person's ability to purchase a gun.
Certainly, we could probably do a better job of securing our schools, but the real way to prevent school violence, the real way to prevent people getting shot in schools, is to make sure that the people who have guns, who shouldn't have them, don't have those guns in the first place.
So, Charlie, is that a viable solution, you know, giving family members, judges, ability to temporarily take away guns?
I mean, it helps, but the problem is that...
Is it a violation of Second Amendment rights is the other question.
Yeah, sure. And
we could argue whether assault weapons are covered by the Second Amendment.
Well, right, that's a good point. They certainly were not envisioned by the founding fathers. I think it's clear enough. You know, that's clear enough. Just the problem with that is that there's nothing wrong with it. It's just that it's easy to do it here, where we already have strong gun laws. You know, the problem is not doing it here. The problem is doing it in the place where you don't have strong gun laws, where you don't have sort of the common sense stuff that's already in place.
Like Australia did as a country.
Right.
Australia after, you know.
Was that 1996, right?
Yeah.
They
yeah.
had a mass shooting that just turned everything around, banned everything, nothing since.
And bought back what was out there. I mean, that was the other piece of it. They put like $500 million into buying back assault weapons that were out there.
And you talked earlier about grassroots leadership, people becoming single issue voters.
Critical.
Is that, you know, is it going to come both top down and bottom up? Or, you know, do you think the real momentum this time around?
Nothing's coming top down on this. This has got to be bottom up. We have seen what is happening top down. This is a bottom up movement.
Look what's happened in the last day and a half. You know, Trump has been tweeting that Governor Scott was there, and neither of them are saying anything about changing gun laws.
Nothing.
You know, it's all the usual stuff about mental health and all, you know, and they.
And remember, Florida is where the Pulse nightclub happened.
Yeah.
And then this happens? Like they did nothing after that?
No.
Yeah, I believe there was a 23-year-old reporter in Florida who, who has been on the job for all of about a year and a half, and she said she has covered already in her short career three mass
listening shootings. To this 23-year-old woman, you felt like you were listening to some grizzled old 60-year-old. You know, she had just been so worn down by this.
Yeah, she was saying she's envious of her older colleagues who, you know, this was a once in a career occurrence for them, and it's certainly not what it's been for her. Let's come closer to home and talk local politics. A new WBUR poll out this week has a few interesting findings. In the Democratic primary for the 7th Congressional District, incumbent Michael Capuano leads challenger Ayanna Pressley by 12 points among likely voters. Do those numbers surprise you or not? We'll start with you, Susan.
Well, I'm going to start by saying those are two great people. I like both Ayanna and Mike an awful lot. We're lucky to have them as public servants in our state in any way. I think this race is going to be a really interesting one to follow. And what strikes me about it is, you know, there's certainly this momentum, I believe, in this cycle of young women, minorities, millennials, feeling like they're going to get engaged. I think the real question for me on this race is going to be, do those voters feel that they need to be engaged in a Democratic primary? Or is that energy that we will see in a final election when people are really trying to put new blood in where it doesn't exist that supports all of the causes that I think young voters in this blue wave is looking for?
Charlie?
Well, I was surprised by it. And I guess when I saw the numbers and I looked deeper into the poll, I understood it better. But I guess for me, there was more just sort of a reflexive reaction that we have an all-Democratic delegation, and that they're there as long as they want, and they never lose. You know what I mean? But when you look at it, and you realize that it's you know, half of the voters in the district are in Boston, and that Pressley is winning in Boston. I guess it makes sense. I think also a large part of this is just that Ayanna Pressley has realized pretty quickly that just in terms of a political launch pad, that Boston City Council is probably not the best, the net best place to be. So
she is an elected official.
And Charlie, you mentioned that Pressley is winning in Boston. To be more specific, she had an 11-point edge in the poll for the Boston numbers. Obviously, Capuano had the
it was like 4-1
exactly outside of Boston. So the question becomes: can Pressley get voters outside of Boston? You know, can she pull some of those support from some of those areas that are outside of the city? Do you think that that's doable, Susan?
Again, I think for me the question is in the primary, is it doable? You know, I think when and I don't know if you're Ayanna, you want to mobilize, as I said, women, young voters, minority voters, and you want to get them ginned up to show up. If you're Mike Capuano, you want to say, I'm a good liberal Democrat who fights for all of the things that you believe in. Is your energy, do you really want to spend your energy going after me? Mm-hmm. So, where the voters will come out on that, I don't know. But that's the question. You know, do you want to go after the, you know, liberal Democrat incumbent? Or do you want to bring new blood into that race?
And she has to try to
make, in a primary.
She has to try to make voters understand that in this case, the primary is really what matters.
And that's the race.
You know, that's the race.
And that's the challenge.
Yes.
And I want to touch very, very quickly on one other part of that poll. And it was regarding Amazon headquarters, the second Amazon headquarters. An overwhelming 71% of those polled said that they would want the second Amazon headquarters located here in Boston. Interesting to me, we brought up the Olympics earlier, very different than it was for the Boston, let's say the Boston Olympics 2024. What do you make of that enthusiasm, Charlie?
Well, look, I mean, I think I can understand it because I don't know that anybody who has spent more ink writing about how Olympics and convention centers and tax giveaways to businesses are a horrible deal for the most part. But you know, I mean, this one, you know, let's see what the deal is, but I'm certainly interested. I mean, most of these things don't come with 50,000 jobs. You know, let's say, let's make sure that those jobs are real.
Yeah, let's see what the deal is, and also let's see what the tax incentives. I know Susan and I were thinking along the same lines. Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the public and the polling, they're not nuts about, you know, tax incentives being offered to Amazon. Now let's talk about a few local media stories. Let's start with the sale of the Boston Herald. The paper is now officially owned by Colorado media company Digital First Media. Today, a federal judge approved the sale. The price tag, just under $12 million. The company will keep 175 of the Herald's 240 workers. That's still a substantial cut. The company, the Digital First Media, also owns the Lowell Sun, the Fitchburg Sentinel and Enterprise, and hundreds of publications across the country. Here's Brian Whalen, president of the Newspaper Guild of Greater Boston.
The Herald's still alive, so it's going to continue on. That in itself is a positive. But let's just hope for the best.
Yeah, I was going to say, let's hope for the best because we don't know how much the Herald will be cut down or cut to size or cut back. How much can the Herald be cut or how much can be cut from the Herald before it's really a shadow of itself?
Well, look, you know, I think you don't have to look very far to see that. They just fired the publisher in Fitchburg and now have a virtual newsroom going there. So, I mean, that sort of gives you an idea of how much they can be cut. The 240 down to 175 is the initial cut. I don't think they're going to stop there.
Still, it's important to have a two newspaper town, don't you think, Susan?
I do think it's important. I fear this purchase, though, because, you know, if you dig past Digital First, what you're going to find is Alden Global Capital. You know, this has essentially been purchased by a hedge fund. This is about making money and investments. It is not about news. It's not about local coverage. It's not about Boston and how do we support our town and challenge the globe. It's about making money, and that frightens me for the long run.
There's a very sobering op-ed in today's Globe about this that, if you read it, will scare you if you care about having two newspapers in this town.
Yeah.
Why don't you say sobering how, in your opinion?
Well, it's just Joshua Benton, who's the head of the Nieman program in Harvard, writes about how essentially, you know, everybody in the newspaper business is going to cut and do all that kind of stuff. But at least some, if you have a chain like Gatehouse, who is in the running here, generally what they do is they make cuts and they obviously try to make it profitable, but they run newspapers. Whereas these folks, it seems like, may just want to get it profitable and then just sell it off. They don't seem to have any concern on the journalism side whatsoever.
Now, we also need to touch upon Tom Ashbrook, former host of the NPR show On Point, produced here at WBUR. Boston University, which owns WBUR's license, dismissed Ashbrook on Wednesday after an independent review verified claims that he had created an abusive work environment. I should also say that a second investigation to determine if he had violated the university's sexual misconduct policies found that his conduct did not constitute sexual harassment. Here's WBUR General Manager Charlie Kravitz.
Yes, it wasn't just me. We all failed to successfully address this issue, and I think we have to collectively take responsibility for that.
And Ashbrook today told Channel 2 this.
I wasn't feeling how my behavior was landing. I wasn't really taking it on board. And what I thought of as just, you know, the rough and tumble of the news business, I don't know if it's times have changed or people have changed or I've changed, but it was perceived as more than rough and tumble. And that was a big sort of 2x4 up the side of the head for me.
Your reactions. We'll start with Susan.
First, I congratulate WBUR for sort of taking this on and taking yourselves on. I'm sure it's not easy to be covering yourself. So I give you credit for trying to be forthright and get that out there and talking about this today. What struck me on this one was, what if I think about it in the context of a Me Too movement, that, you know, and you state here, this is not about sexual harassment. It's about workplace, you know, environment or whatever the right words are. But what struck me was that it's encouraging to me that the Me Too movement is not just about sexual harassment, but it is about people in power and how they treat the people they work with and what kind of an environment you can create for people to be in. And I think we'd all be better off if we were treated respectfully in all our environments. So I give you credit for that.
Yeah, and before I get to you, Charlie, I just want to play this from Joshua Benton. He's director.
It's the guy who wrote the op-ed.
Exactly. Yes, I was getting there, Charlie. He's the director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard, and he told us that because we're listener-supported public radio, the public cares even more about our internal workings. And this is what he said.
Our leadership really needs to evaluate how they could let this happen under their noses. I mean, this On Point was not a weekend show on a college radio station. It's a nationally distributed flagship of one of the largest public radio stations in America. I can say just from being a journalist in Boston that Ashbrook had a reputation for a very long time as a yeller, as a screamer, as a bully.
Charlie, what about this idea that everyone knew and still nothing was done until now?
Well, you know, it is, what can you say? It's very disturbing, and it's very, you know, you also have that deja vu. That's something that we've heard a lot in a lot of different areas, it seems. And that is something that has to be changed. And really, there's no other way to do it than to make those people not feel safe, you know, feel like they can't get away with it.
And let's now switch gears and wrap up with our hubbubs.
Those lighten things up.
Yeah, I was going to say, we are going to lighten things up. I have a feeling quite a bit. You know, those hubbubs are those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week. Susan, do you want to kick off with your hubbub?
Sure. I think this has been a really hard week, right? A lot of tough stuff going on, including, which we didn't talk about, the United States Senate unable to do anything for Dreamers and for DACA. And so an event that stood out for me is the Olympics. And Charlie, I think you're going to talk Olympics too. It's sort of the bright spot going on in our life this week. But to me, when I saw Chloe Kim, that 17-year-old snowboarder who won gold and wrapped herself in the American flag, and her dad, and who was a South Korean immigrant who came here with $800.
I know where you're going with this. The American dream.
The American dream, yeah. You bet. And dad said the American dream. I said, you know what? Everyone pay attention to that.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful story and one that everyone's well-placed to
beautiful
hear.
Beautiful story and an important message.
You bet.
Charlie, take us to Pyeongchang, too.
Yes, I have another American as apple pie view of this. You know, the I know that all the Radio Boston listeners who heard my 2016 hubbub about the number of condoms distributed at the Summer Olympics in Rio have been hoping for a Pyeongchang update.
Oh, good.
And I would, of course, never let them down. It turns out that Pyeongchang will indeed set a Winter Olympics record with 110,000 condoms being made available to the athletes, or an average of 2.3 per athlete per day. This, however, still falls short of the record set in Rio, where a mind-boggling 450,000 were on hand, 450,000 condoms were on hand, which averaged out to 2.6 per athlete per day. Interesting as all this may be, it mostly just leaves me feeling very, very old, and the mere thought of it makes me crave a nap.
Okay. I'm the sports person, but I'm going to do something completely non-sports. I want to end with a bit of a public service announcement about potholes. Hopefully you and your cars will thank me. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation has a pothole repair dashboard, and it lets you know where Mass DOT workers are repairing potholes on state roads and highways. This week was a big week for MassDOT with more than 600 potholes repaired. Hooray. If you have a pothole to report, we'll have a link to the dashboard on our website. And from there, instructions on how to report your personal pothole nemesis. Charlie Chipio, thank you. Charlie Chipio is a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chipio Strategies. thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Susan Tracy, president of the Democratic consulting firm The Strategy Group and a former state rep, thank you as well for joining us.
Thanks, Shira.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. It's been 1 week since the start of the Winter Olympics, and the action is heating up. Germany has 9 gold medals, Norway and the Netherlands have 6 each, and the United States has 5, and that's after 2 disappointing performances from Olympic favorites last night, skier Michaela Schifrin and skater Nathan Chen. What went wrong, and what's in store for this weekend? Joining us to discuss all of this and more from Pyeongchang, South Korea, is Matt Pepin, digital editor for the Boston Globe sports section. Hi, Matt.
안녕하세요.
I wish I could apply appropriately, but I cannot. So I will dig into Michaela Schifrin. She came in 4th yesterday in the slalom, a huge upset for those who follow skiing. It was an event she won in 2014 and honestly was expected to win quite easily yesterday. And here's what she had to say about what happened.
I'm really disappointed. I know everybody on my team is disappointed because... Not so much to miss out on a medal, but I didn't ski like myself today. Slalom is the event that I've been confident and powerful with all season, and I skied sort of weak today.
Were you surprised by the result that Michaela did not even get on the podium?
Very much so, Shira. I was there, and the gasp in the crowd when she completed her run and she was only second was pretty startling. And then to watch as a few more skiers came down and each one continued to bump her down into fourth place. Everyone understood that they were witnessing a big upset. And, as her audio clip told us, she's very much, aware of the way that she skis. She said this many times, how focused she is, not just on winning, but on the quality of the skiing she does. And if she doesn't feel good about it, then, she knows that it doesn't deserve to be on the podium. And that's what she actually said yesterday afterwards, was that, my skiing today was not worthy of a medal.
Well, you've got to appreciate her honesty. Another disappointment from yesterday was figure skater Nathan Chen, who was really a strong contender for gold. He actually finished the short program in 17th place last night. He fell early in the program, then later stumbled on his triple axel, and reporters spoke with him afterward.
Just rough again. Still need some time to think about it, but it happens, I guess, so just try to move on from here.
I mean, in some ways, to me, this was a little bit more shocking than what happened to Michaela Schifrin, because this was a guy who sort of jumps out of the rink, quad after quad after quad, and he just couldn't get it together, and was also a continuation of what we saw in the team event. This is a guy for whom it seems the moment is a little bit too big. Is that your impression?
It is. I think that the pressure of the Olympics is enormous. And, of course, Shira, you've been to several Olympics that, it's a whirlwind of activity here. I can only imagine the kind of pressures that elite competitors face. And I think it's very hard to put that out of mind. They say they do. They work with therapists on the mental side of their, approach to their sport. But, in the end, when you get here on this grand stage and everything is elevated, it just can be overwhelming in some cases. And I think that's what happened. I think that's, I also think that there's a bit of that happened to Schifrin. And I wrote about this, that, when you win a gold medal, as Michaela Schifrin did the day before, there's this entire list of activities that suddenly gets added to your schedule. And so it throws you off. You're doing venue ceremonies. You're doing, meet and greets with reporters, and you're doing the Today Show, and you're doing a medal ceremony at night. So I think that, that played some role there. And for Nathan Chen, the expectations, how many times have we seen the clip of him as just a small boy saying that he was going to focus on this Olympics. So, you know, he brought a lot of on himself, and I think that you know, it caught up to him.
Yeah, and you're drawing us back to skiing with Michaela Schifrin. One of the interesting things about her is her mother is both her coach and her best friend, travels with her all the time. And, you know, I think when you're on the World Cup tour, you're able to shut out those distractions. But as you say, you just cannot do that at the Olympics. There are so many obligations coming down from media outlets like NBC and, you know, the USOC and so on and so forth. Now, besides Michaela Schifrin, what other events have you been covering in the ski world? I know that's your true love, covering skiing and actually skiing yourself. So what would have been highlights for you?
Well, actually... So I've only done skiing so far because the schedule was front loaded with a lot of events and there were certain stories I wanted to pursue. One of my favorites was writing about Ryan Cochran Siegel of Vermont, who went out very early in the Alpine combined and then got a surprise chance to start the downhill and acquitted himself quite well. So I was interested in that story for sure. Today is actually my first chance to do a non-skiing story. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to go to the U.S.-Russia hockey game, which will actually happen very early in the U.S. on Saturday morning. But that game will be for positioning in the medal round of the hockey. So I like that. A lot of Boston connections on the U.S. team. So I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Yeah, and Cochran Siegel comes from a huge skiing family from Vermont. Lots of, I believe, gold medal winners in that family, and a number of his relatives have actually been Olympians as well, which is a kind of a cool New England connection. All right, I have to ask, I know we're kind of bouncing between ski and, you know, snow and ice sports. Is Adam Rippon as big a star? Is the Adam Rippon frenzy as big in South Korea as it is in the U.S.?
Yes.
Good. That's good to hear.
when I'm talking with my colleagues and, you know, at the venues, his name comes up probably more than any other. You know, people have asked if, you know, we've seen what he said, seen what he's done. He is... you know, he's thrust himself in the spotlight, and certainly, you know, his performance yesterday shows that I think he's comfortable with that spotlight because he performed pretty well yesterday.
Now, I know he's in seventh after the short program yesterday?
I think so.
He doesn't have the repertoire of quads that all the other skaters have, but he has the artistry. Any chance for this guy to get on the podium at 28 years old? I mean, I think all of America is rooting for him, and he just wants him to have a phenomenal skate in the free skate. Any chance to see him on the medal stand?
You know, I wouldn't rule anything out. It's the Olympics, and I think that it would be foolish to, and, you know, certainly in all of sports, upsets are part of the reason that we keep coming back to them, and you know, great, great stories of perseverance and triumph are why we keep coming, why we're so glued to sports, you know. But that said, you know, our colleague John Powers wrote today about the three guys that are at the top of the leaderboard sound like they're really
solid.
You know, it's theirs to lose. So I think Adam would need to put on the most magnificent performance of his career. But I also think that he's got that in him. You know, he's comfortable in his own skin here. I think that he has embraced this. And with a what have I got to lose kind of attitude, I'd say this. I'm going to tune in.
Gotcha. Now, 20 seconds left here. The one event you're looking forward to most this weekend.
This weekend? Oh, boy. I thought you were going to ask about the rest of the Olympics.
No, I'm just limiting you to the weekend because it's too big a buffet, the rest of the Olympics.
I want to see the men's giant slalom because right now the U.S. men have not performed particularly well. You know, okay results, but the giant slalom is Ted Ligety's specialty. And if the Americans have a chance at the podium or certainly a gold medal in any of the skiing events, I think Ted Ligety is going to be the guy. And just briefly, next week, I think the women's downhill is going to be awesome. Lindsey Vonn, potentially Michaela Schifrin. So keep your eye there.
Looking forward to it. Matt Pepin is the sports editor for the digital sports editor for the Boston Globe. To read his Olympic coverage and the rest of the Globe's Olympic coverage, you can go to radioboston.org. Thanks, Matt, for joining us from Pyeongchang. Stay with us.
Awesome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Shira Springer. Boston sports radio station WEEI has suspended all live programming today for mandatory sensitivity training. WEEI has had a history of controversial comments and hosts on their airwaves. But the tipping point came last week when midday show host Christian Fourier mocked Tom Brady's agent Don Yee using a fake Asian accent. They were making fun of Herald writer Ron Borges. Borges had reported what he thought was a scoop from Don Yee, Tom Brady's agent. It turned out that Borges was pranked. WEEI host Fourier made fun of Borges by pretending to be Brady's agent, using a fake accent. We have a tape of the segment, but a warning. What you are about to hear is offensive. We are going to play about 10 seconds so you get a sense of what this controversy is about.
Oh, hello. Hello, Ron.
This is Don Yee.
And what is this line? About to get this contract for Jimmy.
Again, that's part of an offensive conversation on WEEI with host Christian Fourier, pretending to be Tom Brady's agent Don Yee with a stereotyped Asian accent. In reality, Yee was born in the United States and speaks perfect English. Fourier was suspended by the station for 5 days. But the incident, along with reporting from the Boston Globe, spurred at least 5 advertisers to terminate or suspend contracts with WEEI. And as we know, money talks, as did Red Sox president and CEO Sam Kennedy. The Boston Red Sox are a radio partner to WEEI. Kennedy told the Boston Herald that, quote, "This pattern of controversial incidents is exhausting, I think, for listeners and for fans in general." So now joining me is Paul Niewa. He's an assistant dean of the Emerson College School of Communication and an associate professor of journalism. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
And also here is John Carroll, professor of journalism at Boston University. He's also WBUR's senior news analyst. Hello, John.
Hello, Shira.
And listeners, we want to hear from you. Do you listen to WEEI? Are you a fan of sports radio? Will the sensitivity training make a difference at the station? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm going to turn first to Paul. You are part of the Asian American Journalist Association, the New England chapter. You've listened to WEEI before. What was your reaction upon hearing these comments as an Asian American journalist?
What I heard on WEEI was the equivalent of plain blackface. It is trying to mock an individual based on stereotypical characteristics. It is something that they're trying to put on and try to make humor of it, and they're doing it in a way to show cultural supremacy over another group. And I think that's the reason why Asian Americans find those that segment so offensive.
Now, John, as you know, as being part of the media, this comes after a string of suspensions at WEEI. Shortly before Super Bowl 52, just a few weeks ago, WEEI host Alex Reamer was suspended for referring to Tom Brady's daughter with unflattering language. What's your reaction to these comments? And honestly, were you surprised at all that this is coming out of WEEI?
Not surprised at all. I mean, these knuckleheads don't even know how offensive they are. And it's interesting because they're operating around a fourth grade level. That's the level of humor. And you have to remember who they're talking to. You know, their audience are the people who Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy dubbed the bloodthirsty shut-ins. So, they are people who are at that level, who expect that kind of talk. And I think that it's not unusual and it's not unexpected. strategically, they really don't know what they're doing. I mean, Tom Brady is one of their most valuable assets there. Tom Brady shows up every week and does interviews. So for two different people to basically go after him by extension, one after his daughter, one after his agents, is just really the height of stupidity.
Yeah, and this is just the most recent example. I mean, this is decades old, you know, whether it's racism, homophobia, misogynistic attitudes that come across the airwaves there. I mean, let's not forget, I think it was only a few years ago where one of the hosts was suspended for comments he made about Erin Andrews, effectively saying that if she wasn't as good looking as she was, she wouldn't have the job that she did. I mean, this is a repeated pattern of behavior. I think we're going to take some calls here. First, there's Rama from Beverly. Rama, are you there?
Hear me?
Yes. What do you think of this? Yes. Can you hear me? What do you think of this controversy?
Well, it's a pattern of if you report to people, pattern of serious negativity, serious cynicism, and they generally ridicule and make fun of anyone who calls in. I don't listen before 2 p.m. because of that. After
we don't have a great connection here. We're going to go to Adrian from Mattapan. Adrian, do you think sensitivity training is going to be effective?
No, I don't think that it's going to be effective at all. Unfortunately, I think someone will have to get fired. You know, people only make changes when you hit them where it hurts, and that's their money. Thank you.
I want to turn to John and Paul here. Do you think sensitivity training is going to be effective? I mean, it also seems to me that they've done it today, taken live programming off the air in an effort to make a big PR splash with this, and that automatically leads me to question their motivation. You know, is this a sincere effort at retraining their staff to be more sensitive, or is this saving face so, you know, they don't get in a position where they're losing more advertisers, or, you know, there is more money at stake that they are losing? So, Paul, what do you think about the sensitivity training?
One training session is a step in the right direction, but at the same time, we shouldn't think of diversity as something you achieve. It's not a state of being necessarily. It's really a process of continuously asking oneself how you can improve, how you can be more open to others, and recognize that great ideas can come from anywhere. The problem with doing this training just one time is that we don't have a sense of whether they're going to continuously think about how they can improve their programming. And so I'm really disheartened. I don't have a lot of hope for WEEI, because their programming, what they sell, has been about hateful speech. It has been they have profited and built their model based on offending others, apologizing, and suspending. And when hosts are, some of their hosts have been suspended at least once a year for the past, you know, 5 years, we really have to think about what kind of culture they're trying to promote, what kind of product they have, and whether this is the modern day equivalent of a minstrel show.
The most effective part of this training, sensitivity training, will be the material it provides the host for Monday morning. I mean, 6, 2, and even, they're going to be mocking this thing from the very beginning on Monday morning. And so I think, sorry, from the PR standpoint, you know, obviously EEI wants to do damage control. And I think that this may do a little. They may lure back some of the advertisers, although if I were the advertisers who left, I'd be pretty slow to go back.
Take a wait-and-see attitude.
Right. Yeah. But I think that they're going to be relentlessly mocked by the on-air people for the sensitivity training. And in that way, it'll be counterproductive.
And I want to turn again to the callers. We have Rob from Stafford Springs, Connecticut. Rob, what do you think? Are you a regular WEEI listener, and what do you think of the recent controversy, or the most recent controversy?
Yes, I am a regular listener. I travel in the city a couple times a week and listen to the show whenever I can. I think your guest disparaging the listeners is a little short-sighted and a little bigotry there. But and I don't believe you're portraying the host's comments in the context that they were done. They weren't about Don Yee himself. They were about the prank Don Yee, not the actual person. I mean, it needs to be portrayed in the actual context which it was done and not just a knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, I think the context is important, but he was using an Asian American stereotype. I mean, I don't think there's any dispute about that. And I just want to ask, when you say that the guests have been unfair to the listeners of WEI, what do you mean by that? How do you see their portrayal as unfair?
The listeners of these programs are like the bottom of the barrel. You know, I don't remember the exact words he used, but, you know, lots of us are very professional.
The exact words were bloodthirsty shut-ins, and they're not my words. They're Dan Shaughnessy's words from the Boston Globe.
Yeah,
so I'm just trying to provide some context here.
Right, but you're portraying those, you're taking his portrayal and using it as your own in this context. And, you know, there's plenty of upstanding professionals who listen to the show and are entertained by it.
I'm sure there are.
I'm going to go to another caller. This is Peter from Dorchester. What do you have to say about what's going on at WEI today and the larger controversy?
Well, I'm thrilled that WEI is finally on a stand, particularly some of those characters. I'm in total agreement with Paul. I've been listening for years. And every time I tune in, I can, you know, I'm an educated man as well, and I have to turn it off. I'm always looking for them to talk about something interesting, like sports, for example. But you know, they always turn to misogynistic viewpoints, racist viewpoints, all kind of underneath what they're saying. It's never truly overt. And I think it would be smart for WEEI to really look at some of what has happened over the last couple of years in particular and fire some of these people. It's the only way they can turn it around, because they are this way to the core. They are grown men, and they are stuck in these ideals, and they should not have a voice.
Paul, I want you to respond to both this caller but also the previous caller, who said context matters. And if you put, you know, what was said in context and the use of the Asian American stereotype, it comes across much differently. But I don't think that's the case. I'd be interested in your viewpoint on that, as well as, you know, the fact that people need to get fired for the culture to really change.
Well, let me put this in context. So just before Fouria mocked Don Yee with that fake accent, WEI also played a tape of Don Yee, so they knew how he spoke. And he doesn't have an accent. And the reason why it's offensive to Asian Americans is that you're mocking a stereotype that Asian Americans are a permanent immigrant class in the United States, that they are never seen as truly American. And this country overlooks that Asian Americans have been in this country since the very founding of this nation. There were Asian Americans who fought for the Union Army in the Civil War. We have had Asian Americans in the 19th century serve as mayors of a city in Massachusetts. So the idea that Asian Americans are fresh off the boat, that Asian Americans are continuously asked about how well they speak English, is something that is deeply painful, considering the historical record and contribution that Asian Americans have provided.
I want to talk to William from Belmont. He has something to say about the importance of context. William, what is that?
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. What I wanted to say is the listener who was talking about the context, there is a very important piece. And through history, when a culture used to make fun of another culture, it's because they want to set one particular culture as the norm, then invalidating the experience of the other. So when the callers try to say, oh, this was a prank and needs to be taken into context, the context of the reality of the world we live in right now, we cannot allow stereotypes that demoralize and diminish the experience of certain human beings among the others who are trying to portray their experience as the norm or the generalization of the human experience in this planet.
Thank you, William. Time is short here, so just one final comment from each of you, kind of what you're looking for from WEI going forward. 15 seconds we've got for each.
The other context here is the context of radio competition and media competition in general. So I don't think WEI really cares if it gets ramped down too much. I think they just want to avoid trouble.
And Paul?
I'd like to see WEI change its programming so it's a little more inclusive and recognizes that making fun of others based on characteristics that they cannot change is not funny.
Well, that's Paul Niwa. He's an assistant dean of the Emerson College School of Communication and an associate professor of journalism. Thanks, Paul, for joining us. Also, John Carroll, professor of journalism at Boston University. He's also WBUR's senior news analyst. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR station. I'm Shira Springer, and this is Radio Boston.